Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, we'll take a look at what's at stake under the Trump regime and also look back at Barack Obama's foreign policy legacy. Folks, I think we're all a little depressed, a bit demoralized. We've seen a ridiculous clown of a figure sworn in as the 45th president of the United States. Clearly, he did not win a free and fair Democratic election. Outside actors had a major influence on the outcome, and Hillary Clinton won almost 3 million more votes. Just as clearly, with unified Republican control of not only the federal government, including the judiciary, and a majority of state houses, things look bleak. There's no question that a lot of damage is going to be done, and a lot of vulnerable people are going to be hurt. But at this moment, this frightening moment in our history, I want to just step back and articulate a plausible path forward, one where the damage isn't that deep or irreparable. I mean, you know that they're going to cut taxes on the wealthy, but you can always raise them again. Some institutional damage can't be fixed. So here's a scenario, and I'm not predicting this will happen. I'm saying that it can happen. This is, again, entirely plausible. We know Trump's administration is off to a slow start. They've only picked a handful of people to fill vital positions. Let's say that they don't get along swimmingly with Republicans in Congress. There are tensions that play out, ideological disagreements between the Trump administration and Congress. So it's not all smooth sailing. And let's say we spend a good chunk of the next year fighting over the Affordable Care Act. Now, that looks like it could be a winnable fight. The GOP is just ideologically incapable of replacing Obamacare with any scheme that doesn't cost millions of Americans their health coverage. They don't seem capable of doing it. So there is the specter of this political party literally killing people, and this creates an intensity gap. The millions of people who rely on the law are going to feel a lot stronger about protecting it than the folks who just hate it because it's called Obamacare, right? More generally, there's a ton of progressive energy out there. You see new organizations are springing up all over the place. People who were disengaged from the process are becoming activists. So let's say that energy translates into a backlash that brings Democrats the House in 2018. 2 years from now. Okay, so now they have a veto. Now they have a subpoena power. They can hold hearings. They can investigate the administration. Let's also say that Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Stephen Breyer can hold on until 2020. So Trump gets one Supreme Court pick, replacing Scalia. And maybe, just maybe, the media becomes more assertive, aggressive in its reporting. Maybe the Democrats and progressives become more proactive in terms of rural organizing and organizing in red states, contesting every district. Now, none of those are outlandish things that will never happen in the real world. All of that could plausibly come to pass. And if that combination were to play out, if that path were to, if we were to follow that path, then, you know, the damage that will be done will be undoable. The key, of course, is that this won't just happen. You personally have to get involved and make it happen. That's really the only way. We've all got to double down. So I've been vacillating between feeling depressed and feeling fighty. But you know what? We've got a moral imperative to fight. It's not really a choice. We have to do whatever we can do to preserve our democracy. Speaking of, we are going to be joined first by Yascha Mounk. He's a lecturer at Harvard, and we're going to talk about the fragility of liberal democracy. Just because you were born into one doesn't mean you'll always live in one. That's his argument. Then we'll be joined by Tom Papinski from Cornell to talk about modern authoritarian societies and how they often defy the stereotypes that most people have of the kind of totalitarian or Nazi state. You can have a soft authoritarian state, and it in many ways it may look like democracy. And finally, as we transition to a new regime, we'll look back at Obama's fraught foreign policy legacy with Heather Hurlburt from New America. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
I've got the mighty, let me tell the news. My head got wet in the midnight dew. Red God, I've been down on my bending knees, talking to a man from Galilee. My God spoke and he sounded so sweet. I thought I heard the shuffle of angels' feet. He put one hand upon my head. Red God, the mighty, let me tell you what he said.
Go tell that lonesome liar. Go tell that midnight rider. Tell the gambling, rambling backslider. Tell him God, the mighty, gonna cool him down.
Welcome back to the show. With Trump's inauguration in our rear window and right populists or authoritarian nationalists gaining traction in many Western democracies, a lot of people are wondering if we're seeing the decline of the liberal democratic tradition, the liberal democratic experiment. Now, political scientists have long argued that once a country becomes a liberal democracy, it doesn't slide backwards. There's some historical evidence to back that up, but my next guest says that the whole project is a lot more fragile than the conventional wisdom would suggest. Yasha Munk is a lecturer in government studies at Harvard University. He's the author of the 2014 book, Stranger in My Own Country, which was published by Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. Yasha, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for taking the time to join me. Let's talk about democracies. Let's talk about the fragility of democracies. Back in college, we learned about democratic consolidation theory. This is the idea that once a country becomes nominally democratic, it develops, let's say, a set of institutions like a relatively free press, opposition parties, groups of elites with competing interests, and these institutions kind of protect that democracy. You and a colleague are calling that view into question, or at least waving a flag of warning. Can you talk about that? Tell us what deconsolidation means.
Yeah, so I think you've described this sort of premise in the political science literature really well. So, you know, it's just this belief that that democratic consolidation is a one-way street, right? That, look, if you're a fledgling democracy and it's in a poor country and, you know, you've just gotten rid of some dictator and you're holding your first elections, you know, there's a good chance that democracy won't survive. There's lots of democracies like that that fail. But once your country is pretty wealthy, once it has over $15,000 GDP per capita, roughly, and once you've had a couple of turnovers for free and fair elections, political scientists used to believe that democracy is basically safe. And one way of thinking about this is that in those places, democracy has become the only game in town. That, you know, everybody agrees to play by its rules, and nobody is really tempted for a systemic alternative. And, you know, as there's been lots of bad news over the last years, and in particular the rise of these quite extreme politicians who are much more critical of basic democratic norms than we could have imagined, I started to sort of doubt this story, right? I thought, well, you know, is democracy still the only game in town, even in places like the United States or Western Europe? And so I thought, you know, what do we actually mean by democracy is the only game in town? And I think we have to mean at least three things, right? First, that most citizens think that democracy is good, that they want to live in a democracy, that it's important to them. Second, that, you know, they're really not open to alternatives to democratic government, like authoritarian rule. And third, that there aren't any, you know, big parties and movements that are anti-system in the sense that they really, you know, challenge not just certain aspects of how politics is done, but the very basic rules that make the system work. And so with my colleague Roberto Stefan Fora, we started to look at some of these measures. And it's one of those moments where, you know, as an academic, you want a paper, you want a finding. But in this particular case, we also sort of didn't want a finding, right?
Right.
Because it would be really bad news. And we were pretty shocked by what we did find. So, you know, in the United States, for example, the number of people who say it's really important to them to live in a democracy has gone down a lot as you move from older to younger people. So people born in the 1930s and 1940s, over two-thirds say it's essential to me to live in a democracy. Once you get to people born since 1980, to millennials, it's less than one-third. And in some ways, the findings are even more striking about some of the other stuff. So, you know, do you think that army rule is a good system of government? This is about the most extreme alternative to democracy you could ask for.
Yes, it is.
Well, 20 years ago, 1 in 16 Americans said yes. Now it's 1 in 6. So it's more than doubled over the course of 20 years. And among young and affluent people, it's actually gone from 6 to 35% over the same time period.
These are the people who would say that they would favor or be tolerant of military rule. The study you mentioned with Robert Foya is available online for listeners who are interested. There's no paywall. It's at thejournalofdemocracy.org. All one word, journalofdemocracy.org. So can you briefly tell me about your methodology here?
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty straightforward. We basically use existing data from the World Value Survey, which is, you know, the most ambitious attempt to gauge public opinion across the world. So they have people doing in-depth interviews in over 100 countries. In many countries, it's in person. You know, in the United States, it's carried out by Gallup. And what's really striking is not, you know, often in political science, you know, you have a striking finding because you've sort of spent 5 years going around collecting data that nobody else has put together. Well, what's really striking about this is that we didn't have to do that. The data was there. It's just that scholars were so wedded to the old story that, you know, support for democracy can't possibly be declining in countries like the United States, that nobody looked at the data carefully and put together the story.
Now, one criticism that I've seen of your paper, by the way, this paper has ignited quite a bit of, first of all, you've gotten a lot of media attention, a lot of controversy. Congratulations for that. That's always good. You want people talking about your research. One criticism that I've seen is that this value survey asks people, do you agree with X? And they can score that from 1, totally disagree, to 10, totally disagree or strongly agree. And you used 10s and 1s and didn't use 9s and 2s. Why is that?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, part of this sort of really bizarre phenomenon, so basically there was a big New York Times article about my research before the paper had even come out, and they showed sort of one particular graph that was especially striking. And, you know, then we got a bunch of pushback from people who hadn't actually seen the paper and would have happily sent it to them.
And we're just
and
looking at the graph.
Seen the sort of larger body of work, and so they sort of like nitpicked about the graph and you know, in social science, you can always nitpick about any one particular graph, right? So the first thing to say is that, you know, the findings we have go far beyond this, right? So that particular question is, how important is it to you to live in a democracy, right? But then, you know, we also have another question, which is, you know, do you think that democracy is a bad or very, you know, do you think it's a very good way of running the government, a good way of running the government, a bad way of running the government, or a very bad way of running the government? And it turns out that the share of people who say that it's a bad or very bad way of running the government has really gone up in a strikingly similar way to a decline of people who say it's important to them, right? So there's no coding issues, there's no, you know, which numbers do you take? So that's okay. The first response. The second response is that, you know, when you look just at that graph, I think it's important, you know, how many citizens say it's essential to me to live in a democracy, 10 out of 10, and that number has declined really rapidly. But if you just look at people who basically are indifferent towards it, right, who answer something in the 4 to 7 range, we're like, yeah, I can take it or leave it.
Sure.
That's basically gone up from being, I'm not remembering the exact numbers, but from being somewhere in the sort of 5% range to being in the close to 40% range. So it's not just a matter of looking at the tens. Even if you just look at the people who basically are mad about democracy, that number has gone up a lot as well.
Folks, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Yasha Munk about the fragility or stability of democracies, depending on how you want to look at it. Let me ask you this. We've seen a dramatic increase in the number of democracies worldwide since, I don't know, the 1970s through the aftermath of the Cold War. You mentioned that the traditional consolidation theory says, you know, you get a couple of secessions, of peaceful secessions, turnovers of government. What would happen if we were to separate mature democracies, states with long-standing democratic traditions and mature institutions, from those where liberal democracy isn't so deeply rooted? Because in the paper you mention, you know, well, you mentioned Marine Le Pen in France. That's a very mature democracy. But also Duterte in the Philippines and the Chavez movement in Venezuela, Poland, Hungary. So I wonder, you know, how applicable this is to the U.S., which has enjoyed, you know, 230 years with a single constitution.
Yes, I think the answer to that is simply that we don't quite know. Not because we haven't done the work, but because there's no real evidence to pull from in the world. What I mean by that is that we can see, and this is part of the point we're making in this paper, that in other countries where democracy has started to deconsolidate, where it was no longer the only game in town, where the share of people who said it's not essential to them to live in a democracy has gone up, where the number of people who are open to authoritarian alternatives has gone up. In those countries, those developments did actually predict a real shift away from democratic government. And that was true in Poland, which political scientists thought was a very consolidated democracy, was doing really well, not at the level of the United States, but, you know, for one big hopeful case of post-communist transition. And then, you know, Kaczynski and his peace party took over last year, and have been really undermining democracy in a very radical way. And
yes,
we didn't quite have an explanation for it. And what we're saying is, well, when you go back a little further, you see that exactly the same warning signs were flashing red as you're seeing now in the United States. Now, you know, obviously the United States has a deeper democratic tradition, a more vibrant civil society, is a much richer country. So can we take the lesson from Poland and just apply it to the United States? Well, I don't know. But the point is that this phenomenon we're describing of democratic deconsolidation is so new in countries like the United States, in France, in other parts of Europe, in Canada, that there is no historical precedent. We can't go back to, you know, 1927 and say, well, you know, 1927, there was also democratic deconsolidation going on in the United States, and look, this is the effect it had.
Right.
So to some degree, you know, we have to take our bets. You know, is the United States similar enough to these other countries that we should be really worried? Or do we think that, you know, it's so different that we shouldn't be concerned that the same kind of phenomenon had pretty drastic consequences in countries like Poland?
Now, here in the United States, I think that it's fair to say that And you can date this back to, you know, whatever point you choose. But for the past 15 years or so, 10 or 15 years, our democracy has been pretty dysfunctional. I mean, pretty dysfunctional. So, you know, I wonder to what degree this analysis might miss country-specific phenomenon, just like what's been going on in the U.S. That would be a political phenomenon, but there's other countries, you know, that might be undergoing economic. If you look at Brexit, for example, that has to do in part with a specific set of circumstances of having a central bank. Countries can't adjust their currency to address downturns in the economy, et cetera, et cetera. And I should point out that you don't mention Brexit in your paper, but a lot of people have been comparing Trump's win with its passage, which is what brings it to mind. So I think about, you know, when I think about Brexit and Trump, I think that there's, the totality of circumstances around these two elections, I see a lot more differences than similarities. So, you know, did you attempt to take into account those kind of country-specific situations that might be contributing to a loss of confidence in democracy?
Yeah, so, you know, it's not part of this paper to give an explanation for why we're seeing people get so disenchanted with democracy. What is striking is that, you know, that is true in a lot of different countries. You know, even despite the big differences between them, and that's just a striking observation, you know, from the data. But you're right that, you know, that doesn't lend itself to a straightforward explanation of why all of this is happening. And in order to do that, we have to go a little bit further back. Now, I do disagree a little bit with your premise, which is to say that, you know, I find, you know, I live in the United States, obviously, and have done for many years, but I spend a lot of time in Europe and other places. And, you know, whichever country you go to, they have their own little story about why populism and far-right populism has been rising in their countries. So in the United States, you know, part of the explanation for Donald Trump is sort of hyper-partisanship and the fact that the parties are so far apart from each other and people become so passionate about political identities. You go to Germany and people tell you the opposite story. They say, well, you know, the reason why the alternative for Germany, sort of in some ways similar far-right party, has been rising is because Angela Merkel, the chancellor, is so centrist, and so there's no distinctions among the main political parties anymore. And so she's left a lot of political space for this new party. And, you know, it strikes me that since the success for far-right populists is actually, you know, very widespread, that you see a real transformation of the political system in countries that are pretty dissimilar to each other. In the United States, but also in France, but also in Sweden, but also in Greece, but also in Hungary, in Poland, in Turkey, and even beyond, you know, you can't just keep telling a set of individual stories. You have to look for the causes that they all share. And this is not in this paper, but my hunch is that there's sort of at least three of those. It has to do with economic anxiety, people feeling that their living standards have stagnated and that the kids might do worse than them. It has to do with the difficulty, and in a way here we're back to the topic at the beginning, of transitioning from being either a monocultural, monoethnic country to a multi-ethnic one, or in the case of the United States and Canada, you know, a country that's always been multi-ethnic in some ways, but that used to be a very unequal multi-ethnic country, and where the people who are unequal are now increasingly demanding equality, and some portion of the population is, you know, performing a backlash against that. And then third, with this sort of really growing divide between urban metropolitan centers and ex-urban and rural areas, which you see reflected in the vote, you know, again, for these sort of populist candidates and movements in very dissimilar places. You see, you know, in Poland and in Hungary and in Brexit vote and in the United States, the rural and ex-urban areas being much more likely to vote for this stuff in the metropolitan ones. And then I think there's a sort of accelerator, which is social media and technology, that sort of reinforces each of these prior developments.
Yeah, I do see that point. I mean, you can all, a lot of this gets lumped under globalization, and that's not entirely wrong. Now, I asked you for 15 minutes. I've gone way over on your time. Before I let you go, let me ask you this. You had a piece in Politico before the election, and in it you wrote, and I quote, that we're in genuinely uncharted territory with Trump. We've simply never seen a candidate with this much disregard for typical constitutional values get this close to the White House. You wrote this shortly before the election. What specifically do you think people should be watching out for over the next 4 and, God forbid, 8 years? What kind of moves would signal to you that he's not just flouting norms or tweeting to get attention, but posing a real threat to liberal democracy in the United States? And is this even a matter of whether of what we should be watching out for Trump or what we should be watching out with in the general public?
Yeah, that's a great question. Look, I mean, normally I would say, so the point of that piece was to say, you know, oh, there's checks and balances, you know, the Constitution is going to save us so we don't have to be worried. And I think that's a mistake. I think, you know, the Constitution gives us the power to resist in certain ways, but it's only when the population is actually deeply committed to democratic norms and acts against somebody who violates them in a systematic way that the Constitution gives us those powers. So it's not, the Constitution can't defend itself. We have to do it on its behalf, and we doesn't just mean, you know, a bunch of people who listen to, you know, a lefty radio show. It means an overwhelming majority of the population.
Right.
And my real worry is that that won't happen. So what you have to look out for to see in how much trouble we're in, well, the first thing I would say is, you know, is the president willing to attack basic democratic norms rhetorically? Is he willing to say that he's going to jail political opponents? Is he going to keep attacking the free media? Is he going to intimidate political opponents? You know, we already have the answer to all of that. I mean, unless there's a miraculous transformation going on, you know, this very second as he sort of, you know, grows into being a president, we have the answer to that. So then the next step, and there we're already in quite extreme territory, is, well, does he start to do some of this? Does he, you know, try to pack independent political institutions in order to bring them to his will? So, for example, really do shenanigans with the Supreme Court and other courts. Does he politicize the state bureaucracy so that, you know, the IRS suddenly starts going after organizations that stand up to Trump, so that the Department of Justice files, you know, very tough charges against anybody who's arrested at an anti-Trump protest, and so on and so forth. To what degree does he enrich himself personally? Because autocratic rule often goes together with self-enrichment and corruption. And then finally, you know, does he at any point actually just refuse to accept the legitimacy of checks and balances? My biggest fear is that at some point the Supreme Court is going to strike down a key part of his agenda, and Donald Trump will simply give a press conference in the Rose Garden, or more likely perhaps in the lobby of Trump Tower, and say, you know what, I don't care.
They're idiots.
They're idiots. I've been elected by the people. They haven't been elected. I don't care. I'm going to go do this anyway. And that would be a real breaking point, beginning of a real constitutional crisis.
Folks, make no mistake about it. You know, Trump seems like a goofball, but there's a real threat here. Yasha Munk, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me this week. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Folks, we're going to take a quick break and then be right back with Tom Popinski from Cornell. He says that everyday life under authoritarian governments is more banal than we tend to think of it as being. And no, that's not a good thing. Stay tuned.
shame the way you hurt me. It's a shame the way you mess around with your man. I'm sitting all alone by the telephone, waiting for your call. When you don't call at all, it's a shame the way you mess around with your man. It's a shame the way you play with my emotions. It's a shame the way you mess around with your man. You're like a child at play on a sunny day. First you play with her, and then you throw it away.
Why do you use me? Try to confuse me. How can you stand to be so cruel? Why don't you free me from this prison? For some time, as a fool.
It's a shame the way you mess around with your man. It's a shame. But you won't appreciate the love we try to make. Oh, it's a got to be a shame.
Why do you use me? Why to confuse me? How can you stand to be so cruel? Why don't you free me from this prison? Serve my time as your fool.
It's got to be a shame the way you mess around with your man. Oh, it's a shame the way you hurt me. Oh, it's a shame, baby, baby, the way you mess around with your man. You've got my heart in chains, and I must complain. I just can't be confined.
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Tom Papinski. Tom is an associate professor of government at Cornell University. Tom, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
It's nice to be with you.
Folks, Tom wrote a really intriguing piece on his blog. It was titled, Everyday Authoritarianism is Boring and Tolerable. I urge listeners to Google it. It's a timely post. So when most people think of authoritarian societies, I think they picture, I don't know, gray Soviet housing blocks and secret police vanishing dissenters in the middle of the night. And you push back on that view in this piece. You talked about Malaysia as an example. What's the reality here?
So I think the vision that you described is very commonly one that we get from the media. That's something that we associate with, you know, Nazi Germany or the Soviet Union. And in reality, most countries that are authoritarian regimes that are led by authoritarian regimes today are not as grim in an everyday sense, although they remain authoritarian and unfree. But today's authoritarians, they run regimes which have decided not to repress all protests completely, but rather to allow it to exist and to allow opposition to participate, but not to be effectual. And so the idea is not to destroy or completely repress the opposition, but to sort of beat the opposition down by demonstrating power and ability to defeat it in what look to be, from the surface or from the outside, fairly democratic types of elections.
And does that serve as a kind of release valve for pent-up dissent? In other words, is it easier to manage polity when you let them, you know, criticize the government on the margins than when you crack down and try to control everything?
Well, there's an interesting new literature in political science on this very question. And the general sense that most scholars of this have is that that's exactly right. Things like elections can actually be quite useful for authoritarian regimes. One thing they do is they give people something to do. They give them a sense that they're participating in something, These were referred to long ago by Philippe Schmitter as the kind of anesthetic function of elections. And so one participates in an election, and in doing so, feels that one has participated in politics, even though one's participation is not effectual. And so it's helpful for managing opposition. The other thing it can do is it allows the regime to learn what the issues that that it needs to address are. And so an election may be an opportunity to observe what the opposition is campaigning on. And if the regime is smart, it may decide that some opposition issues are things that it needs to address itself. And in doing so, remove the ability of elections and mobilization to be effectual by removing the sort of function of the of opposition politics in the first place. So yeah, there's a sense that these they obviously can be a bit dangerous, right? Elections held under authoritarianism can go out of control, and they can the regime has to make sure that it actually wins them. But these are generally seen to be types of policies that that strengthen rather than undermine authoritarianism.
So reading your piece, and again, you focused on Malaysia as an example. You get the sense that people tend to muddle through because they're focused more on their own, I don't know, their own jobs, their own daily activities, you know, taking care of their family, whatever, rather than the system of government. Is there a breaking point, or is there a divining line between a kind of soft authoritarian state and the cliched totalitarian state? Where do you drop that line?
So I draw that line in the way that people like Hannah Arendt and Karl Friedrich drew that line, by thinking about, it's not a bright line, it's not a clear line, perhaps, but we think of authoritarianism as just the absence of democracy, the absence of meaningful elections with rotations of power. We think of totalitarianism as a subtype of authoritarianism that is characterized by government really needing to have control over all aspects of its citizens' lives. And so there's a lot more day-to-day, minute-by-minute monitoring and planning and information collection. An authoritarian regime requires a lot more effective and capacious state, for example. A totalitarian regime requires a much more effective and capacious state. There's not a bright line that separates these two things, but that's how we tend to differentiate them. The interesting question is, what's the difference between authoritarianism and democracy? Because if you follow the way that most authoritarian regimes today operate, they look from the surface a lot like democracies, right? They have these elections, and in democracies, you know, people can, you know, you can lose the election that you wish to win, and you can think it's unfair. And so that murky difference is perhaps the more interesting question to try to address.
And you say that the key criterion for knowing that you've slipped from a democracy to an authoritarian state is that your actions at the ballot box don't necessarily bring about change. Let me ask you this. The United States has had the longest continuous transfer of peaceful transfer of power, 230 some odd years under the same constitution. Do you think that we're as likely to find authoritarian government as banal as those who live in countries where democratic traditions are not so deeply ingrained?
So I would have said that no, there's a kind of American Tocquevillian sense of participation and an anti-government, sort of anti-authoritarian streak here in the United States. But you know, I don't know if that's really true. I think that I've come to realize just how much my real interest in politics is not typical of most Americans. I don't think most Americans really worry about politics in the way that people who are really passionate about it do. And so for, I think most Americans would experience that they're not as captivated by the question of whether or not our freedoms and rights are being trampled on at a day-to-day basis in the way that perhaps you and I are. So if you think about it in that perspective, it's entirely possible that that Americans can accept authoritarianism.
Our last guest mentioned that support for public support for democracy, including in the United States, has been in decline. Let me ask you this, Tom, before I let you go. Why is this important to understand as we see the Trump regime take power? What is the takeaway from your piece as it relates to Donald Trump?
So I didn't mention Trump in my piece, but obviously that was on my mind as I was writing it. I believe that Americans who value liberty and value democracy make a mistake if they think about authoritarianism in the terms that the movies teach us about it, or in the way that we've come to learn about it in school. It's not Star Wars. It's not Nazi Germany or 1984. And so those who wish to be concerned should be vigilant about much smaller things, restrictions on freedom of assembly, restrictions on freedom of the press, refusal to engage with the mass media, and restrictions on what the mass media produces. Those are the types of things that wouldn't bother most people because they wouldn't affect most people. But those are the things that one must watch out for. It's not a question of, are there jackbooted thugs coming away to take away your guns? That's not likely how it happens in the United States. Instead, one wakes up one day and realizes that there are no alternative voices out there to listen to.
Tom Papinski, I want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much.
Folks, stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Heather Hurlburt.
Now I can sing you the storyline, and if you like my story, fine. But ain't none of the glory mine. See, my life was a lonely one, and I was dear mama's only son, with no idea what I'm gonna become. And I didn't have long to know that you don't have to be grown to go. I could have died so long before. Then I finally saw the sign, and I made it on down the line, one step at a time. I feel better, I can smile at it now. I feel better, oh, better, and even a little is still better. Oh, have mercy on me. Oh, it's probably plain to see that I got a whole lot of pain in me, and it will always remain in me. So cold, it's a crying shame. Yet here I am trying again, 'cause I refuse to die in vain. The circumstances put soul in me, and there ain't no holding me. I've got a heart made of gold in me. Can you believe this is where I've been? And when adversity comes again, I'll deal with it then. I feel better, I can laugh at it now. I feel better,
back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I figured we'd round out the show with a look back at Barack Obama's foreign policy legacy. Toward that end, I am pleased to welcome Heather Hurlburt, who directs the New Models of Policy Change Project at New America, formerly the New America Foundation. Heather has an insightful essay at Democracy, the Journal of Ideas, titled Obama's Flawed Foreign Policy. Listeners can Google it right up. Heather, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking the time. It was fairly easy to articulate the Bush doctrine. You write that neither Obama's critics nor his staunchest supporters can really tell you in a couple of sentences what Obama's kind of guiding foreign policy philosophy was. Can you sum up how you see it?
Well, you know, to be fair, he did have a one sentence version, which was, I forget what radio rules you're subject to. Don't do stupid stuff.
Yes, don't do stupid stuff. Right, and it was.
So, you know, he did have a one-sentence version, and in 2008, that was an extremely powerful foreign policy mantra compared to the 8 years we'd just been through. And I think from where we sit today, it's useful to remind ourselves that there was a moment in American history when that was enough of a doctrine to win an election and to win endorsements from lots of Republican national security figures. So, you know, in some ways, I think there was a certain amount of complacency all the way around that was going to be enough of a doctrine. But Obama's idea about what the U.S. needed to do differently in order to avoid doing stupid stuff was a lot more complicated and nuanced. And that is what was never adequately explained to the American people, honestly, and also where, frankly, some of our allies had differences of opinion, and which, you know, is inevitable and normal and is no knock on the administration, but there wasn't always necessarily a plan for what to do when the allies' definition of stupid stuff and our definition of stupid stuff didn't mesh.
You describe a president who really did try to break from kind of well-established paradigms in U.S. foreign policy. And you wrote about, and I'll quote you, his willingness to empower international coalitions that combine state and non-state actors in unprecedented ways. And you say that this is likely to transform both our planet and how power is wielded on it. Traditional realism privileges the state above all else. Can you unpack the meaning of this for us?
Sure. Well, frankly, this is an area where traditional realism is no longer very realistic.
Yes.
If you will, because if you look at the world and who holds the power to either get things done or prevent things from happening, that power has diffused away from the state. That sounds like a rather banal thing to say, but you know, both in terms of force of arms, where you have obviously non-state actors that can wield force in very effective and destructive ways, but also, you know, whether it is the internet, where you have a really substantial portion of the world where the internet is not controlled by governments, the rules for how the internet is used are not made by governments. They're made by these really interesting coalitions of non-governmental and corporate actors, with states kind of frankly scratching to get in from the outside, which has been one of the really interesting dynamics of the last 8 years. You have, you know, instances where private foundations' budgets for health, for development, are greater than entire nation states' budgets for health or development. So the ability to set health policy, education policy has, in large parts of the world, has devolved away from the state. I mean, including in the U.S., by the way, if you think about the era of education policy that we're just leaving, that was a very interesting, if unacknowledged, public-private partnership.
Right.
And, you know, in all those areas, plus climate is another interesting one where you had a coalition of international NGOs, and frankly, you know, this administration basically saying to the NGOs, go ahead and make us do it. You know, please push us to do the thing that we would like to do but feel that we don't have the political capital to do. And the story of how we got from where climate talks appear to be dead in the water through the 2014 People's Climate March to the Paris Accords to the participation of non-governmental entities in the implementation phase of the Paris Climate Accords is all about the diffusion of power and the cooperation of state and non-state entities. And going forward, you know, frankly, if progress on climate survives, one of the reasons that it will is that non-governmental entities are able to continue to put pressure on other governments and are able to make it rewarding for other governments to do things, even if the U.S., you know, goes from leader to laggard again, which I think it certainly will.
Likely, yeah.
And there'll be a number, you know, we saw this, this isn't a new phenomenon. It's an intensified phenomenon, but, you know, this sometime today, the so-called global gag rule will be reinstated, and international health organizations, everything from big nonprofits to local clinics that take money from the U.S. government, will not be able to provide information about abortion as part of reproductive health services. And that happens. That happens every time there's a Republican president. It's nothing new. What is new is that you now have private sector donors that can step in and fill the gap if they choose to, thus, you know, making U.S. policy somewhat less definitive in this arena than a realist state-sponsored view would tell you that it is. And the Obama administration, while, you know, look, no state is ever going to love seeing its prerogatives chewed away at, and there were certainly areas where this administration pushed back on it very hard, but in others, they treated non-governmental entities really as quite full partners. And once, you know, the sort of the history of the diffusion of power is that once groups get hold of power, it's very hard to get them to give it up.
Yes. And you say that this may ultimately disadvantage the United States in creating this space for non-governmental organizations to have a seat at the table, may ultimately disadvantage the U.S. How does that work?
Well, you know, now imagine that you are Nikki Haley, and you go up to New York as U.S. ambassador to the U.N., and your job is to, pick one thing at random. Your job is to roll back parts of the U.N. apparatus that plan for more empowerment of women in security policy decision-making, more empowerment of women in peace negotiations, in peacekeeping, more focus on women's status in society as an indicator of the health of the society, which, by the way, there's really good social science for that. But anyway, you're told that your job is to get the UN to stop doing that. Not only do you have to take on the UN bureaucracy and various other UN member states that may have whatever views they have about it, but you also have now a whole tier of non-governmental actors that are, you know, whether they are producing the curricula, whether they are doing the trainings, whether they are sort of facilitating negotiation processes, they are fully empowered to implement international norms and UN decisions. And they have a stake and they have views and they have the ability to get out on the ground and promote their views at least as much as the U.S. mission to the UN does. So it's another actor that's kind of empowered to push back against you.
Yeah. Now, in the piece, you criticize the administration for doing a poor job explaining its policies. I think this is just so very obvious. You write, and again, I'll quote you, "The White House's choice to limit the rhetoric it expended in support of international goals had multiple consequences. It made legislators less willing to go along with the White House, and it made every vote more politically costly." At the same time, you know, I think it's clear that the expanded drone program, targeted assassinations, the huge increase in special forces operations, and the Afghanistan surge, to some degree, undermined his support from his left. How did the moment of... Let me step back. So it seems like, you know, we always... Everybody on the left, right, and center always assume that the United States has this ability to control events around the world. If only we got the policy right, we could end any war, bring together, you know, any group of combatants. To what degree will Obama's legacy be tainted or perhaps enhanced by events that were beyond his control, that were just his moment in time?
Well, I really appreciate you making the point that it's a fundamental error across ideological differences in the U.S. that we all think that the U.S. has the capability to do anything it wants, whether it's the right saying, well, why don't you do this because you could have done it, or it's the left saying this happened and it's your fault. So I want to underline that as something that none of us think about enough in thinking about American foreign policy. And Obama definitely had at least as many as his fair share of, you know, immense world-altering events that he had nothing to do with and could do very, very little about. You know, the timing of the Arab Spring, not his responsibility, the crisis and sort of near collapse of some of the EU's ability to be a strong actor on the world stage, not his responsibility in any way. I mean, obviously we forget now, but inheriting, coming to office at the moment that he did in the middle of this world economic crisis, not his fault. So having said that, the question that his legacy does hang on a little bit is, what do you do? You know, your job as American president is, you know, at least as much how do you react to how life comes at you as it is what's the dogma that you come in the door with.
Right.
And Obama deserves very, very high marks for not giving in to over-the-top reactions, not jumping into situations, not frankly assuming that things we had done in, say, Egypt 10 or 20 years ago would work now, not assuming that things we had done in Europe 10 or 20 years ago would work now. And that's, you know, kind of achievement by omission, but it's a huge achievement that the administration deserves credit for, and one that I fear we may soon miss very badly.
Not doing stupid stuff.
Yes. So you know, and it's easy. I mean, when people ask you to assess legacies, it's easy to leave this one out, but it's a huge one that the world changes very fast. The world, with the advent of some of the social media tools that we take for granted now, but we didn't 8 years ago, things come at you even faster now than they did, you know, just 8-10 years ago. So the administration deserves a huge amount of credit for figuring out how to handle a faster moving, more diffuse world with as much grace as it did. Having said that, and something else I note in the piece is that Obama's tendency when confronted with a situation he didn't expect was to double down on his core philosophy. And he's actually, you know, Jeff Goldberg quotes him saying, you know, I'm still going to be alive in 25 years when people write longer term assessments of me, and I'm pretty sure those assessments are going to be positive on foreign policy. And in some areas, I mean, I think Syria is a big one where, frankly, it's not clear at all that doubling down on the assessment that this was a problem better left alone he's going to be judged favorably for that.
Yeah. Heather's piece is a really excellent analysis. I just want to note that, as Obama says, history tends to judge presidents differently than contemporary observers do. It focuses on big events, and I think that at some point down the road, we're going to find out whether opening up relations with Cuba, ushering in the Iran deal, pushing through the Paris Accord will be the defining moments of his foreign policy legacy, or whether it will be the, you know, unraveling of Syria, the rise of ISIS, and the drone war. There is a book yet to be written. Heather Hurlbird, I believe we are about out of time. I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me this week.
No, thank you. This was a terrific conversation. Thanks for bringing up the subject.
Thanks again for taking the time. I'd also like to thank Yasha Munk and Tom Papinski. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L, and write an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Podbean, SoundCloud, or wherever else you can find it. I would also like to thank Heather at Hullabaloo, Crooks and Liars, and the Smirking Trump for letting me host the show at their joints. Of course, I would like to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a good week, and stay strong.